Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Talking Politics. Today, Helen Thompson and I are joined by the historian Tom Holland, historian of the ancient world, and we're going to talk about power, corruption, morality, decay, then and maybe now. Talking Politics is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books. As politics speeds up, slow down with a subscription to the LRB, where Brexit and Trump are only part of a picture that includes, well, everything else. Read relevant pieces and subscribe at a special rate at lrb.co.uk/talking. I went to see that Robert Harris trilogy, the two that they did in the West End about Cicero, Tom, and you wrote the piece in the programme, drawing the comparisons then and now. And the audience, I mean, everyone is kind of like just completely taken on board the thought that this must have been a story, the story of Cicero, the story of the end of the Republic, must have lessons for us, and maybe it does. And yet there's also, I think, a feeling when you look at it that there's never been probably a period in the history of modern democracies or the history of the American Republic where people don't wonder, are we...
Or further back.
Are we living through... I mean, it's just the kind of story that everyone goes to all the time when they think they need a template for the end of things. Is it just the story that dominates all the others, the one that we can't get away from?
I think it's because of the distinctive relationship that the West and what previously been called the Latin West has with ancient Rome. The fact that this empire existed, that it was so immense that it stretched from Scotland to the Persian Gulf and now it's utterly gone, haunts the imagination. But if you think of an oak, and when an oak dies, it continues to sustain ecosystems. The kind of the mulch of the trunk and the roots continues to feed creatures. And Rome has similarly has provided a kind of civilizational mulch. So it sustained Islamic civilization, even though Islam defined itself as being in opposition to Rome. But you think of the Baths, or more saliently, the idea of a kind of universalist, God-guided empire. That's clearly a Roman idea that has fed into Islam. Then, of course, there's the civilization of the Second Rome, Constantinople. And although we call the people who lived in that Byzantines, they called themselves Romans, they were Romaeoi. But for both Muslims and for the Byzantines, the Rome that they look back to was the Rome of the Christian Empire. It was the Rome of Constantine and Justinian. What's distinctive about the Latin West is that although Constantine was a hugely significant figure, particularly in the Middle Ages, we have always looked back beyond that to the pagan empire, to the Antonine Peace, to Augustus, to Julius Caesar, right the way back through the Republic, to Romulus and Remus, and then ultimately to Aeneas. And there has never been a moment, probably since it was written, that the Aeneid has not been read in what was the lands of the Western Empire. And so for that reason, Rome, for us in the West, has the quality almost of a kind of great work of science fiction, that it is both simultaneously very familiar and very strange. And the familiarity amplifies the strangeness and vice versa. And I think that that is why, no matter what your politics, no matter what your assumptions, you can always look into the mirror of Rome and find something that reflects or distorts where you are at the present. It's always been like that, ever since Rome fell.
It's probably, I think, fair to say that the Robert Harris version goes for the familiarity over the strangeness. It makes a conscious effort, I think, to normalise some things, particularly some forms of politics, that we would find pretty alien if we saw them in the raw.
The first volume is dedicated to Peter Mandelson.
Indeed. That's a form of normalisation. Yeah. That's one way to normalise it.
He read Rubicon, the book that I wrote about the decline of the Republic.
That's Harris, not Mandelson.
Yes, Robert Harris. At a time when he was looking for a way to write about basically the Blair Project, he suddenly realised that perhaps the Roman Republic could provide him with that stage. And I mean, I don't think he would ever say that he was writing a kind of accurate attempt to recreate exactly how it was. That's not what a novelist like Robert Harris is aiming to do. He's aiming to be creative. He's aiming to extract what he can that suits his purposes from this extraordinary story.
I think what's interesting as well, though, is that every period of history in Europe and indeed North America, certainly in the United States, gets to a certain point and they want to have a fight about what the end of the Republic meant. So if you look at 18th century British politics, they are, you know, writing competing histories of the end of the Republic, and who you side with in that can pretty much tell you what side you're going to be on in the 18th century dispute between the Whigs and the Tories. So why is that the case? Is it because actually, aside from all the things that you so clearly set out, is it because it's such a unresolved political story and that it is possible to read the end of the Republic in quite a number of different ways? Is it a story about power? Is it a story about morality? Is it a story about decay? Is it a story about the relationship between empire and the Republic? So that we are always able, if we want to take a side in our present disputes, to latch onto something about the last century of the Republic and say, oh, it's like that. We're on that side because we're committed
exactly
to these things.
I think that it's the primal narrative in the Western political tradition. It's the narrative that people always look back to. And the reason that it is so effective in serving the interests in the way you've spelt out is that it does kind of serve as a gauge for where you stand politically. So I called the book Rubicon because Rubicon is the river in northern Italy that marked the dividing line between Italy and Caesar's province of Gaul. And by crossing the Rubicon, you know, famously, he then initiates a civil war that results in the collapse of the Republic. So the Rubicon serves as a dividing line between the Republic and the age of what we would, you know, the imperial rule of what would become the Caesars. Now, is that a dividing line between liberty and slavery, which is essentially what Tacitus, the greatest Roman historian, sets it out like? Or is it a dividing line between anarchy and chaos and order, which is essentially what Virgil is arguing in the Aeneid? So where you stand on that that tension tells you a lot about where you are. And it's a disagreement that is not just political. It runs through the way that classicists and ancient historians understand it as well. So Ronald Syme wrote the classic account of it, the Roman Revolution, and he wrote it in the late 1930s. And so Augustus is portrayed as a Mussolini. There's a chapter called The March on Rome. But I've just read a book by the great historian T.P. Wiseman in which Augustus is cast as a defender of the liberties of the people, overthrowing a corrupt and oppressive oligarchy. So these are issues that aren't not immediately resolvable.
I think the same is thing about Cicero as well. It's interesting that Harris picked on that, because is Cicero the great defender of order and liberty in the stable republic, the balanced constitution, using his elegant rhetoric to virtuous ends? Or is he the defender of a class-based order in which the lower classes are essentially having their interests injured by the patrician class, and that the Senate is not defending virtue and liberty or any of the things that Cicero puts in his speeches, but he's actually defending naked class interests?
And a further question is Cicero what he was held to be through the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, the model of what it is to be an engaged figure in political life? A master of oratory, a master of rhetoric, a master of the arts of politics? Or was he an ineffectual windbag who used slogans to disguise the fact that actually he didn't really have any power at all? That's a really live issue for us now.
To go back to Helen's point about what the pull of this, I mean, it's a double pull. It's both open-ended, you can interpret it in lots of different ways, and it is ended. There is a Rubicon, there is an end moment, and we're always looking for our moment of truth. You know, we don't know, are we at the end of this, are we at the end of that? And with the Roman story, there is a moment which is the ending. So particularly in the United States, I think that kind of end of the Republic rhetoric.
But I think it also elides with the fall of the empire itself, with the idea that Rome civilization collapses.
Right, there's the big ending.
And so there's an even bigger one. And the fact that America consciously modelled itself on the Republic. These are virtuous farmers, civically minded, rising up against a monarch, throwing it out, establishing an empire of liberty with a Senate, with a Capitol. If you've got a Capitol, what everybody knows about the Capitol is that it ends up in ruins. And so that dread of ruin has always shadowed America. It's a kind of dual one because, as you say, it's a dread of a Caesar arising, and the whole Constitution is basically, you will know this better than me, but as I understand it, is essentially structured to try and ensure that a Caesar does not emerge.
Ironically, one might say.
Ironically. But then on top of that, there's this kind of nagging anxiety, which China, for instance, does not have. Your civilization may be utterly eradicated and destroyed, and that the barefoot friars may wander past the Temple of Jupiter or whatever, as Gibbon famously noted. So there's a kind of double dread of what might happen, particularly in republics. You know, the whole story in the story of the French Revolution is utterly compressed. So, you know, king is thrown out, there's a republic, woo, this republic's collapsed, you've got a Caesar, and then the Goths come.
So another way you can do the choice, how do we interpret this? And Helen and I have been talking about this, so Helen might want to tell me I've got this wrong. But there's a fundamental question, and it ties in with some arguments in contemporary American political science. The end of the Republic, was it because the people were bad or went bad, were corrupted in some ways, corrupted by wealth or luxury or whatever? Or were the institutions corrupted? That is, were the norms? This is the language that political scientists would use now. The fear for American democracy is not so much that a particularly bad group of people have taken over, because human beings are human beings. They're kind of good and bad in equal measure through the ages. But that the institutions and the norms that hold the institutions together, the ideas that there are expectations about how people behave, that's what's being corrupted.
I think that there is a risk that the Roman Republic is a false friend in the linguistic sense, that it looks familiar, and that...
This is back to the strangeness.
Yes, and that with America and France in particular, there was a kind of conscious attempt to model its institutions and its look on Roman models. And so therefore, it's often tempting to draw analogies that in fact are illusory, I think. And I think that the Republic, you know, res publica is kind of public affairs. So it's not even a constitution. It's a warren of strange precedents and laws and compacts with the gods that have evolved over many centuries and have all kinds of, you know, equivalents of an appendix or a coccyx, things that are still there but have long ceased to serve any particular function. So it in no way corresponds to a kind of modern constitutional state. It didn't function like that. And the other thing is that there are assumptions that govern the way that the Romans seem to have seen themselves that, again, are very strange. And I say seem because, of course, by and large, our evidence comes from the elites, as is always the case. But I think it's possible to see that the essence of the Republic and what made it successful, what made Rome so powerful, was a kind of very carnivorous sense of a civic compact between everyone who had an identity as Roman. And in a way, if you want a modern analogy, it's not the West Wing that provides it, it's the Sopranos. It is, the Roman state was a kind of mafia state. You got compacted in. But again, that's not entirely fair, because on top of that, you do seem to have had a very strong sense of civic virtue, the idea that you consecrate your identity to the success of the community as a whole. And that's more than just the kind of the self-interest of a mafia soldier. You are consecrating yourself to something noble and inspiring. And that is something clearly that people in the Enlightenment in 19th century did find very inspiring. And of course, in its own way, the fascists did as well. And that's another shadow that now hangs over attempts to draw parallels between Rome and the modern.
I think the other difference is that the Americans take an idea that comes out of the Roman Republic and the writings about the Roman Republic, which is the mixed constitution. But the Americans basically construct their republic by separating powers between the different branches of government. Whereas, although you've got some of that going on in Rome, their idea of the mixed constitution is more about balancing class interests within the republic. And then the balance between those class interests changes over time. So the aristocrats represented in the Senate have to make concessions to the plebeians over time. And then you have a period where that kind of compromise breaks down, and then you start getting the rise of what likes to be called, you know, like more popular politics. And that rise of popular politics then gets seen as something that is destructive of constitutional and institutional norms, and that Julius Caesar's triumph at the end is kind of the culmination of that story. But what they're fighting about, let's just personalize it as Caesar versus Cicero for the moment, is basically class conflicts about land reform and debt. So the Constitution's, in a way, constantly trying to adapt to the changing balance of power between the classes that is happening in relation to what's happening in the empire as much as anything else. And in the end, the Constitution can't deal with that. It can't actually resolve those problems in a peaceful way. But the Americans rejected that whole notion of mixed government in balancing the classes in the way in which they constructed their republic. It was about what the institutions themselves did and how the power that each had was used to check each other. Now, I still think there's a legacy of that sort of class-based conflict that's there in the Roman Republic in what we see now, not least because any attempt in which the lower classes are given more political influence gets deemed as something that's constitutionally irresponsible, but it's not the same kind of republic.
Because that was going to be my question. So the parallel that is drawn now is you called it popular, and it's now populist. So Trump is a representative of those classes, and he poses a threat to the American Constitution, as you say, not because he's a representative of those classes, but because the behaviour that comes from that is challenging the norms of separation of powers. I'm currently reading the Mueller report. He is definitely challenging those norms. But do you think that the popular populist thing doesn't work for the reasons you said?
I think that it does and it doesn't. I think that's what's interesting
about
why you can read different things into it. I think that's what Harris was going after, because he wants parallels with members of the patrician class who make irresponsible, feckless promises in this seeking out the popular vote.
So it's the Boris Johnson. I mean, yeah. In the play, that gets the laugh. Everyone gets the Boris reference. And Boris was there on various nights laughing along in his Boris way.
So it's not that...
Which is what Augustus was said to do. He would laugh at jokes made about himself.
Oh, I don't know what to make of that.
Well, because Augustus was a brilliantly skillful politician who knew that you had to keep the upper classes on side by showing them respect, but you also had to keep the people on side by showing that you were a good sport.
Yeah, so it's about, in that view, is that irresponsible patricians who use the grievances of the lower classes in order to seek power for themselves. And that is a narrative that I think people in Europe and the United States have come back to time and time again. And in some sense, the American Constitution and Madison's commitments are kind of an attempt to try and ensure that that can't happen in American politics. But the other way of looking at it is to say, actually, it's the Senate that represents an aristocratic class that simply won't get to grips with the problem of the lower classes, the need for land reform, the problem of debt, and that it uses the arguments about violating institutional norms in order to try to suppress the grievances of those classes. And I think that tension between the way in which, say, people interpret the Brexit vote and Johnson's role in particular in it is still part of our politics.
Again, I think that there is a risk of not recognising just how strange to our way of thinking the way that Romans saw themselves and the way that they saw their relationship to the Roman state. Essentially, what the Republic offered every individual Roman, from the highest to the lowest, was an opportunity to demonstrate virtus, to demonstrate, you know, virtus means properly being a man, so to fulfil your manhood. And if you are at the top of the tree, then you can do that by winning the consulship, as your ancestors did, and perhaps ultimately becoming a censor. And the censor is the greatest office that the Republic has to offer. And the reason for that is that the censor every 5 years works out exactly, within kind of complex levels of stratification, your individual citizen ranks. So every citizen within the Republic knows where he is situated in terms of rank and status and how his fellows will look at him. What that also offers is you can go down, but you can go up. So there is this kind of idea, which perhaps you have in the idea of, you know, going from the log cabin to the White House, the idea that everyone can ultimately improve themselves. The genius of the Roman state in its kind of palmiest days is that it is able to turn this desire to manifest your virtus, to show yourself a man, outwards, against Carthaginians, against Gauls, whatever,
Now, the Roman narrative is that this process then corrupts that sense of virtus, that the influx of wealth, it sort of clogs up the arteries of virtue and courage and civic responsibility, and everyone gets obsessed with celebrity chefs and exotic Greek sex manuals and all this kind of stuff. And they're not devoting themselves to the kind of things that a Roman properly should. And, you know, in a Marxist age, we're obviously highly suspicious of that and tend to see it all as being expressive of deep-rooted class interests. But I think that there is a case for saying that Romans did feel a sense of community that was founded on that sense that everybody had a stake in it, and that the loss of that was felt as a kind of bereavement. Over the course of the final century of the Republic's existence, leading political figures advanced to the degree to which they were able to offer poorer Roman citizens the chance to recapture a sense of themselves as men. And there were essentially two approaches to that, and they were not party political, so it was not the equivalent of Conservative and Labour or Republican and Democrat. It was based on whether you identified yourself with the ancient, stern, unbending traditions that were exemplified in the Senate, or whether you identified yourself with the roistering traditions that were associated with the populace, with the people. This was less about policy than it was about style. And in that sense, I think it does hold up a fascinating mirror to what's going on in America at the moment. Because you would say that Trump and McCain are both Republicans. They're both in the same party. But everyone recognizes that they are polar opposites. McCain, he belongs to the optimates. He belongs to the boni. He belongs to the class of, to which Cicero also belongs, that, you know, there are ideals, there are standards that every Roman is called to live up to. And these are ancient, and they probably involve eating turnips at some point, and they involve kind of dipping yourself in cold showers and all that kind of thing. Whereas a popularis is someone who doesn't necessarily, you know, he doesn't put on mockney necessarily, although some of them do. But you have swagger, you have pizzazz, you understand what it is that the people want to see in a leader. And Caesar is absolutely the archetype of that. He's a fashionable dandy. He blows fortunes that he doesn't have on all kinds of extravagances. He puts on gladiatorial shows where everyone wears golden armor. This is the kind of thing that appalls McCain-type senators, but the people love. And an obvious earlier prototype of that in contemporary politics would be Berlusconi, with his use of football and game shows and things. You know, Berlusconi appalls responsible Italian senators, but he obviously has a, you know, a broad constituency for this kind of stuff.
Talking Politics is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The other difference, and Harris doesn't shy away from this, so the other strangeness is the violence. I mean, the extent to which violence runs all the way through the politics of the ancient world, everywhere, but including in the Roman Republic, and the stakes just were higher personally. So that's the mafia side of it. You get it wrong, you take a wrong move, you cross someone.
Although that only happens with the Gracchi. So the Gracchi are people who, from the elite, who are pushing for land reform, who are essentially taking the side of the masses and who get dispatched and beheaded, beaten to death but with chair legs in a kind of senatorial counterpunch. But the fact that they get beheaded is precisely the horror of it, because beheading is a kind of thing barbarians do. Romans do not behead. And so this casts a shadow, and the fact that it is seen as shocking is reflective of the degree to which, until that point, the Roman state had preserved an internal order. Then you get the shock of Sulla. Again, he's a kind of, he's aristocratic, but he's a louche playboy who marches on Rome with his legions and then goes abroad, wins a few stonking victories, comes back, establishes a dictatorship. and dictator is an office that in times of particular peril a Roman leader can have for 6 months and then has to lay it down, so it's purely time restricted. Sulla, he reorders the constitution, he reorders the kind of the setup of things, the way that magistracies get voted for, the length of time, all that kind of thing, but then he lays down his office, and there's a kind of precarious sense that the Republic is back up and running. But of course it now exists under the shadow of the violence of the Gracchi and of the military putsch launched by Sulla. What is, I think, astonishing about the last decades of the Republic is not that it comes to an end, but that it lasts as long as it does. Because what Sulla has demonstrated is, of course, that it's military power. It's not magistracies. It's not the respect of your fellow senators or the people.
Not even winning elections.
No, it's having legions behind you. And to the extent that, you know, later Roman moralists will say that it is greatness, it is Roman sway that destroys the Republic, they're right. Because what happens is that first you get Pompey the Great, Pompeius Magnus. His conceit is so philosophical that he calls himself the Great. He's always posing. He's got a kind of Elvis-style quiff. He affects the cloak of Alexander the Great. And he can do this because from a young age, he's been a favourite of the people. They've given him a magistracy that exceptionally has spanned the whole of the Mediterranean to clear it of pirates. He is then given a command to go and sort out the Near East, which has been thrown into absolute chaos by the Roman reluctance to annex it, while keeping it in its shadow. And Pompey then comes back from the Near East, you know, with kings in his train, vast amounts of wealth, large numbers of legions. But he doesn't seize control. And his enemies in the Senate are able to stymie his ambition to settle his veterans, for instance. And it's an immense tribute to the power of Roman tradition and the hold that these civic traditions have on Roman leaders that even someone as ambitious and politically thuggish as Pompey never really crosses his mind to establish a military dictatorship. The guy who kind of recognises that and who has commented on what a fool Sulla was for laying down his power is Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar recognises that you simply cannot have power in Rome without having an army behind you, and that's what his conquests in Gaul are all about.
I mean, I think this raises the interesting question about what the relationship of the empire is to all this. Is it in the end that having a republic is not compatible with the empire, in part because the empire does raise individuals, give them military power, Sulla, Caesar, Pompey before? But I just wanted to pick up one thing you said before we get to the empire, and that is that I think that the killing of the Gracchi is a really interesting moment, because the narrative, let's call it the Cicero narrative if we want to say that, kind of wants to identify the populares as the people who break the norms. But actually that first shedding of blood, so to speak, in the Republic after centuries where it hasn't happened, at least on the streets, is actually done by the Senate.
Yeah.
The first act of like breaking down the norms is actually the Senate against the populares rather than the other way around. But I think that if you go back to the period that you're talking about up to Caesar's rise, the question, and I think this is the other reason and in some sense why the point where the two spectres of the end of the Republic and eventual end of the Empire come together, is it actually that the Empire destroys the Republic?
Well, again, something that is very different from us. The Romans don't have a sense of progress. So everything is good if it's old. The Roman state evolves at an incredible lick. It's very adaptable. But its adaptation always has to be disguised as going back to the source. And essentially, as you say, the argument in the last century of the Republic between those who want to enshrine senatorial power as the arbiter of what should be done in the state and those who are more concerned to essentially base their power in their popularity with the people, both of them are looking back to the past. Both of them are casting their enemies as kind of dangerous subversives who are undermining the traditions of the Roman state. And the genius of Augustus, when he emerges out of the carnage and slaughter of years of civil war that followed Julius Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon, the genius of Augustus is that he is able to contain these tensions and paradoxes within him. So with the Senate, he disguises his power. He is primus inter pares.
He's just one of them.
But everyone knows that
he's not.
He's got these legions along the frontiers. And with the people, he gives them entertainments. You know, he likes a laugh at his own expense. He is seen wearing a kind of battered straw hat like any Roman farmer. And his genius is to fuse the kind of optimate and the popularis traditions within him. What then happens over the course of the succession is that you have a kind of yo-yo between those two traditions. So you have Tiberius, who is an optimate to his very teeth. He despises the people. He's a Claudian, the kind of the grandest, snootiest, sniffiest of all the great Roman families. And so that massively influences the way that he's seen and remembered. The people do not like him. Then, of course, you have Caligula, who likewise the Senate hate, because Caligula pushes the idea of giving the people what they want to massive extremes. Claudius swings back to the optimate, Nero back to the popularis tradition. But if you look at how Caligula and Nero are remembered, and then you look at how the liberal press write about Trump, you can kind of see why it was that Nero was very popular, that people laid flowers on his grave after he died, but simultaneously why those who write the histories absolutely detested him.
I just want to push one more Trump analogy, and it goes back to Helen's point about the Gracchi and who first broke the norms, because there is that sense of angst in the American political establishment at the moment around this question. What's the point at which... So there's a consciousness or a feeling that some of the norms of the Republic are being eroded by Trump. But to take Trump down might require the really crucial step in going outside of those norms. I mean, impeachment is this complicated question, but as it were, to remove him outside of an election. So it's not going to be beheading, right? And it's not probably going to be an overt act of violence, but in constitutional terms, there is this kind of almost terror. Are we going to have to be the ones?
And bear in mind that what precipitates Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon is precisely a legal threat of that kind. Caesar has spent 10 years in Gaul, winning great glory for the Republic, conquering vast new territories, plundering gold, sending it back, beautifying the city. So he deserves right by the state, but his enemies are jealous of him, and they have manoeuvred things that they are waiting to prosecute him once he has laid down his political office and therefore loses his immunity from prosecution. And the dilemma that Caesar faces is, does he stay within the constitution, lay down his powers, go back to Rome and have his career destroyed? Or does he cross the Rubicon with his armies? When he's walking the battlefield of Pharsalus, where he's destroyed the armies of his enemies, he says, this is what they wanted. They wanted this. You know, they pushed me, Caesar, after all I'd done, into this corner. And there's no question that Caesar and his followers, of whom there were many, regarded the legal manoeuvring of Caesar's enemies as petty and unconstitutional, that the law was illegal.
That rings a bell.
I noticed that Lindsey Graham was saying something yesterday, I think, about how he didn't want America to go down the road of using basically political prosecutions against families, talking both about Hunter Biden and about Donald Trump Jr. But I think there is the difference in the Rome case, and this is where, again, I think it is alien, is that these were essentially, weren't they, private prosecutions that could be brought against individuals. There's nothing like a state prosecutor that can also neutrally decide these things.
And again, it's important to emphasise that the essence of the Roman state is a patronage system. So it's about great families. And a patronus, of course, gives us the English word patron, but it also gives us padrone, the Italian word for a godfather. That essentially is how the Roman system functioned, that every great family offered benefits of clientage to people, and that's how it functioned. The greater a figure you were, the more benefits you could offer your clients. The reason that the Republic collapses is that in time kings become clients. Cleopatra essentially is Caesar's client and then becomes Antony's client. And that means that all the lands that have been conquered by Rome become kind of collateral damage in shootouts between these rival padroni. And the final shootout is between Antony and the young Caesar, Octavian as he's called, who will become Augustus. What Augustus is then able to do is to establish himself as the ultimate godfather. Everything flows from him. And that then is sufficiently stable that it's able to provide not just the city of Rome, but all the vast swathe of territories and provinces that Rome has conquered with the kind of the security that, you know, a good mafia godfather can offer shopkeepers. And so that, and that again focuses the issue on, you know, what's more important, order or freedom? You know, what do you go for? What's better? Is it better to live under a free republic where everyone's tearing the chunks out of each other, or is it better to accept the mastery of a single man but live in peace?
So another strangeness, familiarity question that comes up in that context is just about power and personal powers. This is partly about Rome, but the whole ancient world, emperors, then moving forward, popes and others, extraordinary power in the hands of one person. And we live in a world where, in some ways, the power is greater. So Trump has the nuclear button. Zuckerberg, there was the famous cover of The Economist with Zuckerberg as Augustus, thumbs up, thumbs down. So his network is 2.2 billion people, an unimaginable scale of power, and yet not the same kind of power. So no, it's not Cleontalist power, it's not life and death power. As someone who's moves from the ancient to the modern and back again, is the quality of power, is there anything about it that's unchanging, or should we resist those parallels?
You mentioned popes. Actually, the power of popes and emperors is radically different. It's the Christianization of Rome that explains where we are now. Because what happens with Rome is that it has a sense of itself as a civic entity that is potent, carnivorous even. It despises barbarians. It feels free to conquer them. It feels free to slaughter them. It feels free to enslave them. But what ultimately happens is that the whole world becomes Roman. And over the course of the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries AD, the challenge for Roman emperors and for the Roman state is not to affirm the distinctiveness of the citizens of Rome, of the city, but to find a way in which all the various peoples who live within the framework of the empire can be constituted as Roman. There are various attempts at this. So Caracalla, at the beginning of the 3rd century, gives every free male within the empire citizenship. Various gods are auditioned for the role of a kind of supreme god who can serve as the divine patron of the Roman Empire, which is equated with the world. Christianity passes the audition because Christianity has at its core the idea that there is no Greek or Jew. You know, there is no slave or free, even, right? There is no man or woman, really radically. But it has the idea that the Roman state is able to synthesize is the Christian idea that all human beings are created equally in the image of God. And this becomes an incredibly potent one that, of course, in due course outlives Rome. So the city of man, Rome, falls. The city of God, as described by Augustine, survives and endures. And that sets up a polarity that then passes into early medieval and high medieval Europe. There is the dimension of politics. There is the dimension of the flux of earthly things. And that is defined by the saeculum. And the saeculum in Latin originally means the span of human memory. 100 years, 120 years, it comes to mean 100 years, so hence century. Men live, they die, things pass away. Against that, you have the order of God, that is eternal. So you have the idea of there being this dimension of the saeculum and then this dimension which the church has control gets absolutely embedded down. In the 11th century, church radicals are able to seize control of the bishopric of Rome and kind of essentially establish it as the papacy, as the head of a kind of pan-global state. But it's one that is transplanted from the dimension of the cyclone, and therefore from the dimension of earthly kingdoms. And so embedded within Western political discourse is the idea that you have earthly politics, but there is also something more beyond that. That, of course, in itself becomes a source of immense political power. So that's what enables the papacy to send armies off to Jerusalem or Lithuania or whatever. And then that power gets contested, and the Reformation and then into the Enlightenment, this idea that there is a kind of moral validation, a dimension of progress, of moral improvement, becomes something that people compete after. It reflects this kind of primal idea that there is the secular and of course what becomes beyond the dimension of the secular. But that is a division that does not exist in antiquity. it simply does not exist. And so you have to set that one side. You know, I mean, Zuckerberg, you know, he has this immense power, but Facebook is seen as being morally highly problematic. And the moral criticisms of it, therefore, are a massive threat to him.
And in a century, it might not be here.
Yeah, very, very off the cyclone.
So one of the things that is, I think, increasingly noticeable in the last few years is that it isn't just in the West that the idea of Rome and what it represented, including in the sense that you've just been talking about its later Christian sense, seems to be part of political discourse that Vladimir Putin is quite keen on presenting himself as a Roman emperor. Yeah. And he's also quite keen on the idea of Russia as a successor to Byzantium, as the third Rome. Why is it that the imaginative legacy of Rome goes to the east as well as to the west? And is there anything that's going to give Putin any real political purchase in his rather personal exercise of power?
There's a wonderful paradox about this, which is, of course, that, you know, we've been talking about parallels between Rome and America. But, you know, as we've also said, what we know about Rome is the Republic falls, the Republican system collapses, and then Rome itself falls. What we know, decline and fall, that is the essence of it. For Russia, it's different because although the first Rome falls, although the second Rome, Constantinople, falls, the torch of Romanitas has passed from Rome to Constantinople to Moscow. This is the tradition. The niece of the last emperor of Byzantium marries Ivan III, and he is hailed by Philotius, this monk, as the ruler of the third Rome, and the third Rome will never fall. And this is an idea that passes down through the emergence of the Russian Empire. So when they annex the Crimea is important to Catherine the Great, and Potemkin hails it in these terms and says, well, you know, we've taken back the land that was ruled by Rome and where the ancestors of the Slavs were baptized into the Orthodox faith. Crimea is doubly holy to us because it links us to the first Rome and to the second Rome. This kind of obviously went into abeyance in the Soviet period, but even then you had this extraordinary story, which may be apocryphal, but even if it's apocryphal, it doesn't matter, because it's revealing about the stories that are told, how when the Nazis reached the borders of Moscow, Stalin sends an icon up in a plane to go round the limits of Moscow, in exactly the way that when Constantinople was besieged, they would send icons up onto the wall and the Virgin would be seen patrolling. You know, so these are deep, that have a living integrity in Russia in a way that they don't in the West. And for Putin, Crimea matters in the way that it mattered to Catherine the Great. You remember the famous image of him discovering a Greek amphora in the Black Sea. This is a really kind of potent idea, as of course is the idea that they're getting back into contact with the wellsprings of their Christianity. So you had all the images of priests blessing the plains when they go in. Whereas in the West, I think, you know, there's a massive reticence in claiming any link with Rome because of the fascists. Because all that iconography, the eagles, the standards, it's unsettling. Whereas in Russia, they don't have that issue. So the paradox is that, in a sense, the identification with Rome is vastly stronger in Moscow than it is in Washington.
I mean, could you almost say that in the West, Rome has become a kind of morality tale there, but for the grace of God?
I think so, yeah.
And in Russia, it is the grace of God, you know, it's not there but for.
Yeah.
And so these are completely diametrically opposed. I mean, we are living in different worlds in that respect.
And I think we find it difficult. Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has explicitly said that Russia is the heir of Byzantium and therefore ultimately of Rome. And this is something that means that Russia is deserving of respect. And likewise in China, you know, the sense of China as an ancient civilization going back beyond the revolution all the way back to the first emperor, it's a really important part of Chinese cultural identity. Whereas in the West, Rome is a much more ambivalent, it's bloodstained and it fell.
What is interesting here is that if you look in Britain, say, in the 18th century, there was a party that looked enthusiastically in the end at Caesar, which were the Tories, or at least part of the Tory party, the country part of the Tory party. Once you get into the 20th century, though, and once that the emperor and Caesar has been claimed by fascists, as you say, then that ability to look sympathetically at Caesar just seems to disappear.
I think that's absolutely true. But I think there's a further dimension, which is that in Britain, and generally in European countries,
the study of Latin and of classical culture is associated with elites. And so the ability to speak Latin becomes a marker of being upper class. And that, of course, is a trope that Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson make great play with.
We'll tweet the link at tppodcast_ to Tom Holland's fantastic website. There is so much there. Next week, Chris Brooke is back. Where's he been for the last year? We're going to talk about the Euro elections, the fate of British politics. The week after that, we're talking to Jared Diamond, author of Guns, Germs, Steel, and most recently, Upheaval, about the fate of the world. My name is David Runciman, and we've been talking politics.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.